Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. Music of Frédéric Chopin. We just heard the Waltz number 3, Opus 34, in F major, better known as the Cat Waltz, performed by Jeffrey Siegel. Once again, we are delighted to have a good friend and a wonderful raconteur as our guest today. His name is Jeffrey Siegel. He is a wonderful musician. And Jeffrey, welcome to Crossover.
Nice to be back with you.
Now, you have to elucidate on that because what you're doing is you're going to speak about some very exciting things on some very exciting programs. So I think what we would like to do is find out what you've been doing and what you will be doing this season. You have a series that you do. How many years have you been running that series?
This is our ninth series here at the Kimmel Center, where we do a series of three keyboard conversation programs in the course of the season. I'm a concert pianist. I've been soloist many times with your great orchestra. But in addition to that, I do solo piano programs I call keyboard conversations, Jill, which are concerts with commentary. I stress that they're concerts in that every work on the program is performed in its entirety. What we like to think of as the plus is that prior to the performance of each work, I speak to the audience about the composition in non-technical language. And I do it with the hope that whatever I say about the composition in advance of it being heard will make the listening experience for the avid music lover something more enriching than a pleasant ear wash of sound. And thankfully, also, we get a lot of people, Jill, who attend these programs who know they've been missing something, not to have Beethoven in their lives. And they're looking for an accessible and inviting introduction to great music where they'll feel at home with it. And I'm happy to say that our keyboard conversation programs at the Kimmel Center draw plenty of both the avid music lover who wants his listening to be enriched and people who are giving classical music a try. And it's been very gratifying to do this series. And of course, it's a great place to do them.
It's also a wonderful thing to do because a lot of people that love music and listen to it don't really know in depth about it. The ones that are musicians, that's one story, that's another level. But what you do is you actually enhance the whole listening experience by explaining in, as you said, non-technical terms.
For our program tonight, all Chopin, the passionate patriot. Chopin was indeed a very patriotic Polish person. And he felt very deeply his Polish roots. Therefore, the nationalistic Polish dances, the Polonaise and the Mazurka, these Polish dances had great extra musical meaning for Chopin. In fact, the very first work of Chopin's that we have is a Polonaise. He writes it in 1817, which means he writes this piece when he's 7 years old. And it's not a bad piece. The composition begins with two sighing phrases. One could actually put the English words sighing, sighing, over these expressive phrases. (Clears throat) And then comes the musicalization of the Polonaise rhythm, that which makes a Polonaise. It's this characteristic rhythm. Yum, bum, 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 yum, bum, 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 bum. And here's the musicalization of that Polonaise rhythm with the 7-year-old genius. And then he gives us the main tune of the composition, which is a rather bittersweet one. There is much about this composition which is not only remarkable for a 7-year-old, but there are elements in it which point the way to the mature Chopin to come. Let's now hear this Polonaise of the 7-year-old Chopin.
Just heard a segment recorded at the Kimmel Center, a live performance of the romantic music of Chopin. It was the G minor Polonaise that Jeffrey Siegel played. So now this season you're going to be doing three again: The Glory of Beethoven, The Romantic Music of Chopin, and Mistresses and Masterpiece. And you are, of course, we are very, very interested in that final one, I'm sure. The Glory of Beethoven, I think many people love Beethoven and don't really understand the music in terms of technically. But is that always terribly necessary?
It's never necessary. What we have in that particular program of Beethoven are some early compositions of his that he is very clearly writing to impress his public, to win friends for himself, as he has now settled in Vienna and is trying to impress and ingratiate himself with this upper-crust Viennese society. And then we have on the program one of Beethoven's most shattering compositions, the Appassionata.
Oh, it's a wonderful
which he writes very soon after he has to accept the fact that he is going deaf, that this is not imaginary, and he is wondering what purpose life can have for him as a musician if what he has to look forward to is the loss of his hearing. And it's a human struggle, the diary of an afflicted soul that every human being can relate to. It's one of Beethoven's most powerful works. And the program will also conclude, Jill, with one of the compositions Beethoven wrote after deafness engulfed him, a composition of great spiritual exaltation and interior depth and profundity of thought. That's also tremendously moving because it's one of his most personal compositions. So we get a wide range of Beethoven's musical expression. One need not know anything or nothing technical about the music to be able to feel it, to be moved by it, and to be able to relate to it. And when people know what's going on in his life and how he's taken these musical ingredients and cooked up the piece, they're really on the inside track when I sit down to play the piece straight through.
And, of course, this is just solo piano repertoire that you're talking about. I did hear stories about him with the emperor when he was conducting and playing. He really couldn't hear, and he would have to put his head down on the body of the piano and listen, I guess. It's a very dramatic story. I mean, Beethoven's life was very dramatic, and And I would imagine that this is probably really so fascinating to find out. And even if you don't understand the technical aspect
of it. It's not necessary to understand the technical aspect. One only has to bring to a great piece of music an open mind and an open ear and a willing heart.
This program is entitled The Power and Passion of Beethoven, and we are going to begin with one of his most beloved compositions, the work known as Fur Elise. Here is the main tune, the main melody of this composition. That is a melody known to every piano student and every parent of a piano student. This composition has a rather interesting origin. It comes as a surprise for most music lovers to learn that this work was not published during Beethoven's lifetime, and he would not have wanted the work to be published. Beethoven died in 1827, and this work was first discovered, so to speak, in 1867, 40 years after the composer's death, when the manuscript was found amongst the private papers of the recently deceased Therese Malfatti. Now, Therese Malfatti was the daughter of one of Beethoven's many physicians. Some Beethoven scholars believe she was a romantic intimate of the composer, and some Beethoven scholars go so far as to say that Beethoven proposed marriage to Therese and that she turned the composer down, preferring instead some good-looking, wealthy, aristocratic landowner. On the manuscript in Beethoven's hand is the dedication for Therese, Beethoven, April 1810. The editor who prepared this work for publication, a man named Null, misread the dedication, and instead of the name Therese, he substituted the name Elise. And therefore, this very famous piece of music has come down to us dedicated to the wrong woman. Well, a rose by any other name, etc., etc. What we have here is a private gift on Beethoven's part to his lady friend. This is not a hackneyed student piece of music. This is really an intimate love poem in sound. And it seems to me when one knows what this composition is about, one hears it in a different way. Let us now hear For Therese by Beethoven.
Music of Beethoven, the very popular Fur Elise. We just heard a performance by our guest today, Jeffrey Siegel, as part of the kind of program that he gives in his keyboard conversations. How do you feel when you discover? I mean, you're always discovering. I think musicians consistently discover through the years. What happens to you in preparing the works for presentation, like in this format? Do you ever stop and say, gee, you know, I didn't know that, or wow?
Of course. And very often the work you're doing as an interpreter leaves you feeling, I wish I could share this with my fellow listeners in the audience. And reading it in program notes is not enough. You have to, first of all, bring it alive to them in sound itself. And of course, as you and I've discussed before, Jill, the guiding light for me in doing these programs is Leonard Bernstein.
Yes,
who could talk about a piece of music briefly and in non-technical language and get across to everybody so that when he turned around to perform the composition, you really did feel that you were getting more out of it as a result of what he said.
And you have what he had in the sense of passion. You know, passion and I guess it's admiration and love. That they're all of these things that come together when you as a musician learn, you know, technically what to do and what it sounds like. And then you've achieved another level. And I think what is so successful with these programs that you've been giving is that you feel beyond just explaining what, you know, in words, what is going on. And that is, of course, that's the edge that is so very, very important.
Of course, the performer must understand and the performer himself must be deeply affected. But the real test is the listener going to be deeply affected? Is this great music going to be communicated to the listener? And it's the listener's response to the music that I want to enrich.
Yes, but again, you're dealing in many instances with people that there are fine points that they don't understand. So I think what it is you're bringing the whole experience to a certain level. Not that you're talking down or being too obscure. You're kind of in that middle ground, I think, and that's very difficult to achieve.
But as I say, Mr. Bernstein was a guiding light for me and for people like Leonard Slatkin. And I think one of the reasons these programs have continued in Philadelphia and that the audiences are so supportive of them is that they are getting it and they're enjoying the particular concert with commentary format. And one of the most popular programs, Joe, that we've done in the past was the All Chopin program.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. Mm-hmm. So the Glory of Beethoven is on Tuesday, November 12th. That's it's a one-time shot.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
And the romantic music of Chopin, well, how many times have we heard that phrase used? Chopin romance, of course. But tell us where do you go with that?
As I remember, one of the best received programs of all of them that we've done in the nearly decade of keyboard conversations in this great city has been the music of Chopin. Mr. Arthur Rubinstein, with whom I had the privilege of doing some coaching, used to say that there's something about Chopin's music that relates to every human being, and they may not know why. Is it the beautiful melodies? Is it the character of the music? Is it the sheer beauty of the sound? But people love to listen to the music of Chopin. It's very human, of course.
It's emotional.
It's just a fantastic feast for the ears. And Chopin, like Beethoven, had certain things going on in his life at certain time that affected certain compositions.
Romance.
Of his. Right. But more having, again, to deal with health problems.
Yes, of course.
And feeling an émigré in a French country, though he was half French,
Polish,
he was very much Polish. Mm-hmm. And again, I think people can really relate to this without necessarily sensing the facts through the music. We're, of course, going to have a Polonaise on the program and a beautiful berceuse, a lullaby that Chopin writes that you feel the rocking rhythm and the glorious, delicate sonorities. We're going to have some of the vivacious waltzes. And ironically, Chopin wrote scherzos for the piano. Scherzo, as you know, Jill, means a light joke.
Yes.
But he wrote some of his most demonic, angry.
I was going to say nothing funny about
those,
right?
and very exciting music to listen to. And of all the great composers, Chopin is really the only one who wrote almost exclusively for the piano. Amazing. He's one of the greatest composers of all time. There are no operas of Chopin. There are no symphonies.
But concertos.
Yes, very few non-solo piano works. He almost writes exclusively for the piano, and yet so incredible is this work. But there's really no more popular composer than Chopin.
Well, and that's going to be taking place on February 3rd. That's a Monday, February 3rd. And then
I'd like to call it a pre-Valentine's Day special.
Well, you know, anything to do with love and passion. And we have a lot of love and passion in music, but somehow, you know, it conjures up when you see Chopin, the name even, you say, oh, well, that's very romantic.
And it is.
And it's not terribly romantic to play, though, I think. It's very challenging for our audience. I mean, Chopin, a lot of his works are... Really,
it's very difficult. Of course, Chopin was one of the great pianists.
Exactly.
He was not a virtuoso public performer like Franz Liszt was. Chopin hated to play in public. really did. But you heard him at best when he was playing for a few friends in a salon around midnight. But he wrote for the piano as only a virtuoso can, who understands pianistic configurations and also extracted a whole infinite bouquet of sounds and sonorities that absolutely enchant the listener with the piano sound.
For the concluding work on our program, a Polonaise, arguably one of the most famous pieces of music ever written, here's the main tune. I'll bet you've heard that before. And what a glorious, uplifting, heroic tune it is. Now, if you or I had been so inspired to have the genius to write this tune, we would have started the composition with it. But Chopin does not. He wants to set the stage for it. What's he going to do? He's going to give us some music of ominous rumbles, of crashing chords, of harmonic dissonance. And from this chaos, this musical chaos, this glorious tune will emerge. And when it does, it'll be all the more effective because of that which preceded it. Here's how Chopin begins the piece. How much more glorious that tune is when it emerges from that chaos. It's so easy to take particularly these popular musical masterpieces for granted. This is just one example of many masterstrokes in this extraordinary work. Now, there's another tune that we hear in this composition, this rather noble tune which we hear in the middle section of the piano. That's the tune, but to be honest with you, we don't always hear it in performance because of the problem of the accompaniment. Chopin has an accompaniment for this tune, which is quite extraordinary. He has the accompaniment be a four-note descending musical cell, four descending scale tones, which he asks to be played in octaves. And that's the accompaniment for the tune. He asked that cell, with the four descending scale tones played in octaves, he asked that cell in the accompaniment be played 104 times in a row. It's not only one of the most famous endurance tests in the piano repertoire, but it is a real balance problem for how do you keep that very active accompaniment from drowning out the noble tune above. Franz Liszt likened that accompaniment to the charge of the Polish cavalry going into battle. And all too often, it's the charge of the Polish cavalry which knocks out the tune. And all too often in performances, this is what one hears. An incoherent din of sound, and I certainly hope that's not going to happen tonight. But when it does happen, the fault is not Chopin's. The fault is the performer's. It is a very difficult spot to play. What a remarkable work this is. It's a Polonaise because we hear constantly that Polonaise rhythm. Yum, ba ba bum, 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 yum, ba ba bum, bum, bum. And yet, in this Polonaise, there comes a place where he stops that rhythm altogether. And he's going to give us some improvisatory music. music that seems to wander from one harmony to another. It's as if indeed the composer is lost and he's wandering in some deep dark forest, trying to find the road back to the main tune of the composition. Here's the spot I'm talking about, and you really have the feeling that he's getting more and more lost. Now, how is he going to get from there back to... How he does it is one of the musical miracles of this composition. There are many. The ending of this work is the complete opposite of the ending of the Polonaise you heard in the first half of the program. This is life-affirming. It's upbeat. It's as if he's saying in musical tone, I will not be defeated. And I think it's because of this enormous spirit, this optimistic ending, that this work, it's one of the reasons why this work has achieved such enormous popularity. Let's now hear the heroic Polonaise of Chopin, 1842, the Polonaise.
Music of Frédéric Chopin performed by Jeffrey Siegel. We heard the heroic Polonaise, the Polonaise in A-flat, Opus 53. Do you ever throw in some personal, little anecdotes about the composer? I know you have on the third program, you talk about mistresses and masterpieces,
yes.
So that probably answers the question.
You've led very well, Jill, into that third program. Mistresses and Masterpieces, yeah. As the title might hint to you. Is going to be musical compositions that the composer was inspired to write by, shall I say, significant others in the composer's love life. And we're going to have music of Brahms, more Chopin, Robert Schumann, of course, and Franz Liszt.
Oh, my.
This one is particularly fascinating. These pieces of music probably would not have come about as they did had it not been for the composer's personal relationship with the significant other in the composer's life.
Well, I think in those years, I think it was very important to the connections. It's always important for musicians to have good connections so that they don't have no money, so they need to foster these relationships. And a lot of times I think it's very easy. I mean, love and passion is all part of the whole human makeup. So what better vehicle than these gorgeous pieces? But I think that's never, you've got to have somebody that will be a mentor and will have connections. And that hasn't changed since, I'm sure, the time of Bach or even before.
Well, Yes, certainly with the Chopin pieces, there are various ladies that inspired particular compositions of his, and we'll hear them. With Franz Liszt, he met a woman who felt he was a good piano player, but he needed to be cultured up, so to speak, and they traveled together to Switzerland and to Italy. Years of pilgrimage.
Marvelous.
And
things.
That would not have come about without Marie de Gaulle's influence on Liszt. And she opened his eyes to the beauties of nature, etc. And we're going to hear some of these pieces. There is a very youthful, almost stormy, passionate piece of music that Brahms wrote that he dedicates to Clara Schumann.
Mm.
There's a good story.
There's quite a
story there. And of course, Robert Schumann, at his own admittance, most of the piano music that he wrote in his 20s would not be what it was. It had not been for his relationship with Clara Wieck, who became Clara Schumann.
Right.
And there, even in some of these Schumann works, have specific melodies that have extra musical meaning. When Robert and Clara were not allowed to share letters with one another.
Yes.
Clara's father didn't want them.
They're Boten, right.
But the musical compositions could be exchanged. That the father allowed. So there are certain melodies that have extra musical significance that you find in these compositions, usually five-note descending scales, that are thought to be confirmation of their love for one another, but it couldn't be put in print, so to speak. I mean, when you're on the inside track and you hear this pieces of music which express this, it's very, very moving, very deeply affecting stuff.
It's exciting, too, and it's very human. I think it puts a human cast on all of this beautiful art. I mean, that goes for visual art as well. You know, you appreciate on a certain level, but when you find out about what was going on, even with a painter, what was going on in his life or her life when they were painting or composing. Of course, I think we have to have any art sparked by passion and emotional response. I mean, you can't do it without that. You can't live without it. And I think what you do is you bring it close to the audience on a level where they not only know the story, they get the human aspect, but they also learn something about the music, and you don't play so badly either.
Well, I thank you. I thank you about that. In this day and age where we're absorbing so much sound, whether we want to or not, I think we need to really listen to what we're hearing. And that's what I'm trying to do with these keyboard conversation programs. And Jill, I should mention that every one of the programs concludes with a short question and answer bit where the audience is invited and encouraged to ask questions. And that's how I know really the mixture of listening experience and age group that attends the programs, because we have a wide range. I get everything from what edition did you use of that Beethoven sonata to how many hours a day do you practice? Did your mother make you study? Which is fine. You know, it breaks down that perceived wall
of course.
The audience member feels is between himself and that person on the stage. And we have a wonderful, you know, including several minutes at the end of each program. And many people ask me about things I've said earlier in the program where I might not have been clear or they wanted to comment on it. It's a wonderful aspect to this program.
As part of his group of composers falling under the romanticism of the Russian soul, Alexander Scriabin stands out, and what we listen to now are two preludes, Opus 11, number 5 in D major, and Opus 67, number 1.
Scriabin is a rather enigmatic composer. He began writing music that was Chopinesque in style, but in his later years, Scriabin's mystical musical musings were written in a musical language that bordered on, indeed it was in the neighborhood of, atonality. Most of Scriabin's works are for his instrument, the piano. There are no fewer than 83 preludes, and we are going to hear two of them. The first, from the year 1896, is certainly Chopinesque in style. It's believed that Scriabin for a time actually slept with a volume of Chopin's works under his pillow for inspiration. Perhaps that was the inspiration for this particular piece. I'm going to play the opening phrase for you. For the second of these two preludes, and I'll play them for you as a group, we are going to jump ahead 15 years to 1912.
It's hard to believe that the same person who wrote that Chopinesque prelude wrote this one. I'll play just a few moments of it for you. Someone once called this piece the mist of a nightmare, and there does seem to be evil, sinister thoughts. There seems to be evil lurking all around. At one point in this murky piece, the music intensifies, and Scriabin actually writes into the score the French word déchirante, which means being torn apart inside. The listener might wish for some pleasing final chord at the end of the work to signify that in the midst of all this murky meandering, there's a happy ending to the story. Some pleasing final chord like this one. Scriabin gives us a final chord for this composition which resembles the one I've just played, but it's somewhat different. Not the happiest ending in the world. Two preludes, very different works of the same composer, Alexander Scriabin.
We just heard two Scriabin preludes, Opus 11, Number 5 in D major, and Opus 67, Number 1, performed by pianist Jeffrey Siegel. And now, how many seasons have you been doing this, Jeffrey?
This is our ninth season here. The longest running series is in my native city in Chicago at Northwestern University, believe it or not. We're starting season 44.
Oh, my. Well, of course, season. We've aired them for seasons, too, a number of seasons.
I'm delighted about that. It's always a privilege to not only be speaking on WRTI, but to have my interpretations of the music being heard.
Well, of course, this is all going to take place now Tuesday, November 12th, and then Monday, February 3rd, and then Tuesday, April 22nd. So there will be advance notice on these concerts. What do you suggest in terms of there are single tickets available, there are group tickets available, and there are subscriptions as well. So
yes.
How do they do that?
I believe they call the Kimmel Center box office, which is 215-893-1955. And single tickets are also available, 215-893-1999.
That's easy.
Yes, and we're usually able to accommodate everybody, although we've had some programs that were so well received that we had to turn some people away at the last minute, which I never like to do. So we hope people will make arrangements early to attend.
You know, there's a quote on this little blurb about you. It says, "This is an artist who means every note he plays." I love that. That's from the New York Times. And that really encompasses everything that you do. You love it, you're good at it, and you explain it, and you're not above that. And I think that's really wonderful. And we're so thrilled to have spoken with you. Jeffrey Siegel, again, your concert series is November 12th, February 3rd, and April 22nd. Tickets are available, and we'll certainly be hearing more about that. And thanks for coming to Crossover.
Always a great pleasure to talk with you, Jill. Thank you for inviting me.
We've been speaking with pianist Jeffrey Siegel, who will be appearing at the Perelman Theater in the Kimmel Center in three separate programs of Keyboard Conversations. Tuesday, November 12th, The Glory of Beethoven. Monday, February 3rd, The Romantic Music of Chopin. And Tuesday, April 22nd, Mistresses and Masterpieces. Hear now the first of five preludes by Sergei Rachmaninoff, the Opus 3, Number 2 in C-sharp minor, performed by pianist Jeffrey Siegel. This is an excerpt from his lecture, The Romanticism of the Russian Soul, Rachmaninoff and Others. I'm Jill Pasternak. Until next time.
We are going to begin with arguably Rachmaninoff's most famous solo piano piece, the Prelude in C-sharp minor. He was still a teenage music student at the Moscow Conservatory when he wrote this piece. As Rachmaninoff was later to say of it, the musical inspiration was so strong that it simply came upon him one day and seemed to write itself. He published the composition in Russia, and the composition soon caught on like wildfire, to such an extent that it was almost impossible to go to a concert anywhere in the world or to walk down the corridor of a music conservatory anywhere in the world without hearing someone have a bash at this particular prelude. It made the name Rachmaninoff famous. And when he started to give concerts, when he started to concertize, to tour, he was known as the composer of this prelude. And wherever he went, he had to play it over and over and over again for the next 50 years. Is it any wonder that he grew to hate the piece so? There's another reason why Rachmaninoff loathed this composition. And this reason is not nearly so well known. When he published the work as a young man in Russia, he was not the international cosmopolitan figure that he was to become. When he published it, he neglected to secure for it international copyright, which meant that for the millions and millions and millions of copies of the sheet music sold outside of Russia, Rachmaninoff received not one red kopeck. And this did not help him to like the piece any better. One can say what one likes about this composition. It is a rare example in music of a young composer who has already found his rather unique musical voice. In a way, no one other than Rachmaninoff could have written this composition. It has many characteristics in it that we find in later works of his, more mature works of this composer. His love of bell-like sounds, and the surging, sweeping melodies that capture the ear and touch the heart. And this feeling of inner pathos, which is so much part of the romanticism of the Russian soul. In later life, Rachmaninoff loathed this composition so that he could only refer to the work as it. Let's hear it. It is not a bad piece.
For a second listen to selected crossover interviews, visit WRTI.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Patti, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group Incorporated. Thanks for listening.